Greetings, everyone. This is Brother Bedford, and welcome to my Conversations with Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs. Now, you're about to hear my recorded interview with business mogul and icon, Michael V. Roberts. Enjoy.
This is Brother Bedford, founder of the Association of Black Entrepreneurs, and I am so excited about today's conversation that we're about to engage in. It's very rare that you have an opportunity to not just speak with a successful entrepreneur from our community, but really an icon who's really building a legacy for his family, but also for those of us who want to follow into his footsteps and really build successful businesses. And he has businesses across many different industries. He's a visionary. He's a futurist. He's a modern-day capitalist. He has successfully built his St. Louis, Missouri-based, the Roberts Companies, into a multi-million-dollar, multi-dimensional international enterprises. It consists of real estate development, television broadcasting, wireless communications, broadcast towers, aviation, hotels, theater ownership, and a management consulting as the base. Now, he has been featured in numerous newspapers and articles such as Forbes, Success, Business Week, Commerce, the Black Enterprise. He has received numerous awards and accolades, and if I just tried to list those, we wouldn't have enough time for this interview. But what Mr. Roberts has done, besides granting us this interview to share some of his dynamic insights with us, is that he has written a book. He's an in-demand speaker. He speaks it to many corporations and trade organizations, but he's distilled his business philosophy into a book that all of us should have. It's truly the secrets to gaining wealth and authority. The book is called Action Has No Season, and I'm going to be pushing this book for the entire year for all of those who follow me and subscribe to my services. This should be mandatory reading for anyone who is truly interested about making their dreams come true. This is about being a very strategic thinking business person. This is no fluff here. And so without further delay, I want to thank you for joining us on the call today, Mr. Roberts, and sharing your time with us. Thank you for being on the call.
Well, you're very welcome, and thank you for that very generous introduction. It is one of those moments when one hears a little bit about your past that you begin to think, well, have I done enough? And the answer is, there's no such thing as doing enough. In the real world, we must continue to take action. As you know, the title of my book is Action Has No Season. And I'm a firm believer in us realizing that our potential and our purposes are rich, they're robust. The older and the more experienced you get or experiences you receive really only continues to be a part of the seedbed by which you continue to plant new seeds at any age, mm-hmm. especially for those of us who are serial entrepreneurs, to look at a new business venture, to consider a new horizon, and to begin to address it aggressively and, as we would say in my book, to be an actionaire, to pursue your ideas, your dreams, your aspirations, your vision. Mm-hmm. With passion, courage, and confidence and bravado, and don't sit back and wait for someone to fulfill your dreams or just find your destiny. It's up to you to do that.
Mm-hmm. Man, thank you so much. And I really want to get into the actionaire, and I really want to get into your philosophy. But for those who don't know much about you, can you just give us how did you get your start as an entrepreneur? I mean, this has been I've studied you, and you have a tremendous portfolio and a tremendous track record. And one would have to know that you had a very humble beginning or a beginning that nowhere compares to where you are now. So how did you get your start as an entrepreneur?
Well, I started probably when I was about 12 or 13, when my dad bought a gas lawnmower, and my chore around the house was actually around the yard, and that was to cut the grass once a week. And he paid me my $5 for that, my neighbors thought I did a pretty good job and asked me to consider cutting their grass. I did. And they paid $10 for the grass to be cut. So it was something that triggered in my mind when I realized that cutting grass for my dad was a job, cutting grass for my neighbors was a business. Hmm. And then I recognized that my value will maximize itself when I'm in business and running a business and creating businesses. And to the point that I could actually have enough yards to be cut, my younger brother came along and I had him cut it with me so that he could make a little money and I could expand. And that was at the age of 12 or 13. So I think once that's implanted, a variety of things start to churn, mature, and bake. And as I went along, I found myself going on doing little things even in college and then law school. But you have to understand, you know, I come from an African-American classic middle-class family. My father worked at the post office for over 39 years, and then he joined me when I was initiating my business with my brother, Steve. My mother was a part-time and then full-time teacher. So we weren't rich, we weren't poor, we just didn't ever have any money. Mm-hmm. But and people, I think, know what that's like. You know, you continue to live your life, everybody does a little bit of a business hustle here and there, and you just keep growing. And that same hustle that, you know, was implanted in me as a young adolescent matured into a full-blown capitalist who's interested in big job creation. I've created jobs for over 10,000 people in my years, and I've had over 76 companies and just scores of other business pieces here and there that's allowed me to really grow. I mentioned I went to law school. I did. I finished at St. Louis University School of Law, studied at the World Court at the Hague Academy of International Law in Holland, and at the International Institute of Human Rights in Strasbourg. You know, I would find fellowships or scholarships or borrow money to do much of this travel, because I recognized that for me to maximize my potential, I needed to be able to see the world, live it, understand it, and experience it. And I believe that also builds a degree of courage and confidence, and you begin to realize that there are things out here that are sometimes unseen to those of us who grew up in an urban inner city area like we did, mm-hmm. went to public schools, but there's so much more to be seen. So I always encourage people to travel and mm-hmm. to explore all types of new opportunities. I am leaving soon to go to Accra, Africa, and I plan to spend a little over a week there, not only learning the culture, but also looking at the potential business opportunities that may exist. Because I'm always looking for the next deal, the next opportunity. Mm-hmm. And that is why Action Has No Season was my title, because I believe that there's no other time any better than the present to take action on your dreams and your ideas.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That's beautiful. Now, you mentioned, in just giving us a brief history, you mentioned 76 companies hiring over 10,000 employees. Now, I'm sure within that there were many trials, many ups and downs and problems that you had to face head on. And I get that question a lot from many of my subscribers when they run into hurdles and they're ready to give up their business dreams or they just feel like they can't break through. Can you just give us an idea of just some of the problems that you faced in your entrepreneurial journey and how you overcame them?
Well, the first thing I want people to do is get equipped with this philosophy. Mm-hmm. And I will ask it in the form of a question. What would your life be like if you could eliminate the fear of failure? Mm. Okay, so let's break that down. Brother, let's break that down into two words. First word, fear. Mm-hmm. Fear is just a mental construct. It's not of nature. It's not grass growing. It's not the wind blowing. It's something that you were not necessarily born with, but you created. And as you became an adult and entered opportunities that may have, you know, been what you might consider too much for you, because you had this fear, then you have to ask the question, well, what's the origin of the fear? And if it's nothing but a mental construct, then can we break away from that and just let it go, release ourselves from it? Second word, failure. Every day when you wake up, you're given 86,400 seconds. That's 24 hours for those doing the math. And every moment that you think of that moment, it's already gone. So you have to live every moment to its fullest extent, a very existential concept. But it's one that makes a lot of sense when you stop and take pause and think about it. So if you have a business, a relationship between, you know, a man and a woman, or relationships in your family, or businesses, as I mentioned, and the outcome isn't as you would have liked, but you learned and you gained from those experiences. Mm-hmm. Is that a failure, or is that an experience that you gained from? Mm-hmm. I respectably argue that it is nothing more than an experience. And so, there's no such thing as failure. Mm-hmm. And if we eliminate the fear of failure, then what types of business opportunities might we now embrace? Looking back, what type of businesses did we miss because of a fear of failure? How often have you heard people make comments like, oh, I had that idea 2 years ago.
Oh,
yes, and now that idea is making somebody millions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no better time to take action than the present and to live every moment to its fullest extent again, because even as you think of the moment, it's already gone, won't come back, it's over. So fulfill it to its fullest extent. So now, to your point, those companies that you just indicated, I probably had two times that many companies, three times that many companies over the span of my businesses. I mean, 200 businesses at least. Many of them, most of them, did not pan out. Or many of them had hit their sunset, where they were. It was just at a point where we've done as much as we can, and we've and it's time for it to shut down. That's okay. Life ultimately shuts down for all of us, doesn't it? So who's to suggest that businesses can't have a sunset at some point? Sometimes that sunset may come as a result of customers changing their minds. It may be because of certain ways that you are administering the business. Maybe it's because some of these banks that have, you know, been bailed out by us, the federal government, decided they're not going to do anything to help you by refinancing your loans, and then they let you fall. Mm-hmm. We've all had to go through that. Anybody who tells you that they've always been successful, you need to look at them with a jaundiced eye and question them, mm-hmm. and question your relationship with them, because it's probably not true. Mm-hmm. So I say to anyone and everyone, consider that business model, that idea, that plan, and recognize that when you develop the concept, there's basically two elements that you need to apply. One is empirical knowledge. That empirical knowledge is the business plan, the written down, the numbers, the balance sheet that hopefully will be filled out with great success someday. The other component is instinct. And too frequently, we don't use our instinct in our business or even in our personal life. We will apply, you know, empirical knowledge, just basic numbers. Mm-hmm. And sometimes we think, well, if we have the numbers right, everything's going to fall in place. But you don't have the instinct or the vision, so therefore it doesn't. Mm-hmm. You know, I will tell you that there are those who can write a perfect business plan and the business still would not succeed as they would like. I will also say that there are those who have an instinct and a concept about a business. Their business plan isn't as tight as it maybe needed to be. Maybe they don't even have it, but they see the vision and they understand internally what to do to get there. And so they pursue it. So it's no do-it-yourself kit. Nothing is absolute. I speak at a lot of colleges, and some of the things that I challenge the deans of business schools, and whether it's Harvard or Texas Southern or Jackson State or Kellogg School, I will ask this question. I'm an African American. You have African American students. So if you have 100 case studies in your business school, how many of those case studies are African American businesses? Well, the answer is usually, I don't know. Maybe one, maybe two out of 100, even at the historically black universities and colleges. And I'm asking them a second question. Well, do you honestly think that the playing field is even for those African-American entrepreneurs who are coming out here trying to start a business? And whether they do it or not is not an even playing field. But more importantly, why don't we have more case studies on businesses that have been started, run, and operated by African Americans? It's because we don't take the time to recognize that here we are in an environment of capitalism. This is Black History Month, and I speak at a number of schools. In fact, in a couple of weeks, I'll be at the University of Wisconsin speaking. And one of the things I'm going to say is this. I'm going to first ask the question. If you lived in a communist nation, what would you be called? Communist. If you lived in a socialist nation, what would you be called? A socialist. If you lived in a capitalistic nation, as we are capitalists. Whether you like the word or understand the word, it doesn't matter because it does exist and that's what we are. Now, if I read normal history as history was presented growing up before African American history was introduced, I read about Rockefeller and Mellon and Vanderbilt and Ford blended into the history of America. If I go and I go to Black Studies and read Black history, I don't see that.
Right.
I don't see the it's filtered out. I don't see the level of detail in the history of this country that were created by the Elijah McCoys who created and patented items back in the late 1800s and the early 1900s. If we read about George Washington Carver, we sort of read about him in the eyes of slavery and civil rights, things like that, but in fact he was a businessman.
Right.
You see? But we don't take on, we need to stop, catch our breath, and rewrite all of the Black history that exists on the college campuses. It needs to. It's not just, our history is just not civil rights and slavery freedoms. Okay? It's not. It is as much a part of the Americana for us to be in the capitalist environment, and we were there, and it is a part of the history. Just like they had a Rockefeller or a Mellon or a Vanderbilt, we had an A.G. Gaston and a C. DeLores Walker and C.J. Walker, and who was a woman who was a billionaire, a multimillionaire, in the early 1900s.
Right.
So maybe her name is mentioned, but an A.G. Gaston, who was a man out of Birmingham who had about a third grade education and lived to be 102 or 103, but he had a radio station and he had an insurance company, and he had a hotel. In fact, in Birmingham, he was the only place Martin Luther King could stay back during the segregation years.
Right.
But I mean, he had multiple businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't he blended into the annals of history the same way that that we see Martin Luther King?
Mm-hmm.
And so I pitch everyone listening, go back for a moment and make sure that our history is being written even today. And, our current activities of what's going on out here, let's make sure that we include businessmen and capitalists so that when young people are reading about our history, they're also reading about these success stories that exist. Because if we don't set the examples, what do we have? You know, today our kids' examples to be, you know, wealthy, you either have to have a ball in your hand,
mm-hmm.
or you have to have a microphone to be a rapper of some kind,
mm-hmm.
or you have to be an illegal pharmacist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have too many success stories. We have thousands, maybe a million people in business today. It's all over the place. Why aren't we writing about that and cataloging it and having it so that we can read it and understand it? And you know what happens when I go to the schools and I ask them that question?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they say to me, well, we don't know where to find them. I said, listen, Black Enterprise has been putting the 100 top black businesses for 40 years.
Right.
In their June edition. Don't tell me you don't know where to find them, and if you don't, then here, go do it. And I've asked the schools, especially recently at the dean of the business school at Howard, who's a good friend, get your graduate students to start writing case studies so we can put together a case book and blend it not only for the business school but also for our black history books,
mm-hmm.
and make sure that our folks get an opportunity to recognize it. Now, I wrote my book. It has a lot of my stories about my different businesses and my philosophy, and I hope that it will be read by those who are listening and will spread the book around because you got to take the time to do this, and it's hard. I know it's hard for those of us who are authors, but we have to. We must take the time because that is how we can give back.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think we have this aversion to capitalism? You mentioned that term. Why do you think we have this? We shy away from. Even just the term, I think when I saw you in Atlanta a few years ago at the Power Networking Conference, that was a topic of discussion, and you pretty much put that up front that we have this aversion to even just mentioning the term black capitalist, but you've embraced it wholeheartedly. But why do you think the rest of us really backtrack off of that term?
Well, I asked that when I spoke at a Black Power Conference once because I was getting an understanding of what's in their mind. You see, and what was in the mind of the black power organization, the activists, was this. Their confusion is this. They see capitalism as plantation, as the days of the plantation and slaves, where the slaves were being exploited by the plantation owners, and they call that capitalism. I say to them, that's not capitalism. That's called slavery.
Right.
There's a big difference.
Right.
Now, why do people shy away? Because people use terms like, well, that sounds like people who embrace greed and exploitation. Well, guess what? Everybody's a little greedy, and everybody exploits somebody and something all day, every day, whether they know it or not.
Right.
You might use a different word, but it's still the same thing.
Right.
Now, my point is this. If I'm going to go out and I'm going to help someone, am I better off helping them with money in my pocket or being broke? Capitalism with a heart, capitalism with a swagger that lends itself to bettering the community works someone says, well, you know, what are you doing? I mean, you know, you're running these businesses. I'm not just running them businesses. I'm creating jobs. Mm-hmm. Now, if I have a choice between giving a church or a Salvation Army $1,000 or the ability to employ somebody for 2 weeks for $1,000, which makes the most sense?
Hmm.
Not-for-profits should be in the business of putting themselves out of business.
Right.
What we should be doing is focusing our money and attention on businesses and job creation. Because if somebody has a job, you don't need to give them, you don't, there won't be the levels of homelessness by veterans coming back from these wars. You know, you won't see people finishing college and freaking out because they can't find a job after we promised them if you go to college, your life's going to be better off.
Mm-hmm.
We need to create jobs, and we do that through creating businesses, and businesses in this country function off of capitalism. And that is why we have to learn to embrace the word, but we have to let it filter and bake in and let it be something that we can embrace and not walk away from or run away from, but acknowledge that it is here. And we live in a capitalistic nation, you know. Yeah, when I ask people this question, what's the first thing you have to do if you have a dream? Well, first thing you got to do is wake up.
Right.
And then you need to sit up, and then you need to stand up, and then you need to go after that dream and pursue it with a lot of courage. Mm-hmm. And sometimes there are going to be people who are going to be in front of you, including relatives, telling you, oh, maybe you shouldn't go into business. You know, Uncle Tyrone tried that, and look what happened, and da-da-da. Well, mm-hmm. You know, after you wake up and you sit up and you stand up, sometimes you just got to tell people to shut up and get out of your way.
Right.
You just got to go after it, and you got to give it a shot. And if the outcome isn't as you want it, try another one,
mm-hmm.
and another one, and another one, and keep going. Because it's within us to be, it's such a matter of our instinct. We have, as Africans, we have the oldest DNA of any human on the face of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And it is through the DNA that your instinct comes. Because there are things inside of you that surprises you sometimes. You have no idea, you know, why you're walking down the dark street and something tells you to cross over and go another way. Mm-hmm. What is it that allowed Michael Jordan, whose parents were not even 6'5", they were 5 feet something, he grew and became such a great basketball player? Was it skill or was it instinct? It was a blend of both. Or what is it when a little 4-year-old girl gets on the piano at age of 4 and starts to play Beethoven and Mahler? What is that?
Mm-hmm.
You see, that's within our DNA, and we have all of these elements that are there. People are unique. Everyone is unique. You know, some are artists, and some are sports, and some are business, and some are, most of us are a blend of all types of DNA memory components that are inside of us. So all I'm saying is get in touch with who you are, and don't...
In your book, I mean, I'm just thinking about it, and I read some of the reviews and the things that people said, and I agree with so many that your writing style, I mean, you really give where a person, if you're underlining or taking notes, you end up with pages and pages of quotes that you can turn into affirmations or whatever and just live by daily. But one of the chapters that really stuck out to me, and I want you to kind of expound on this, it was about developing your inner constitution. Because I get a lot of questions from people. We've already addressed the issue of fear and fear of failure, but they still don't know the next steps. And one of the things I say is to really try to get clear on what it is that you want to do, but also knowing your talents, your skills, your gifts, and your strengths, trying to analyze yourself to know that. And you address that in the book, actually in two different chapters, but you really talk about developing your inner constitution. Could you expound on that a little bit for us?
I'll try, yes. I mean, the inner constitution, again, is something I was really just referring to, and that is your instinct. And what is it that Mother Nature almost is saying to you to do? When you really question your own capabilities, but you somehow deep down inside know that you do have the capability to do it, and you just need to go for it. But there are other factors that pull you back. Sometimes there are people who are saying it. Sometimes it may be the difficulty in finding financing and some of the other issues. But here's what I find exists in the minds of people. I will ask an audience, how many of you think outside the box? Most of them raise their hand. So then I ask the question, well, if you're thinking outside the box, what's the size of your box? Is it the size of this room? Some kids, it's the size of a jail cell or a casket. Mm-hmm. It's sad. The reality is there's no such thing as a box. There never has been and never will be. You're not thinking outside of something that you're inside of. All you have is the horizon. Mm-hmm. And the horizon is endless. But what happens is our society puts these mind tricks on us, and we fall for them. So I just want people to stop and think, you know, it's kind of metaphorically speaking, that, you know, there's no such thing as a box. Mm-hmm. And so don't have to worry about thinking outside of anything that doesn't exist in the first place. Be fresh with your thoughts, mm-hmm, and recognize them for that. When I wrote my book, I wanted to write clear philosophy, and I wanted it to be understandable. I didn't need to use the big words I would learn in law school and other places. I wanted to keep it profound, but easy to understand, and make it so people can embrace it and adapt to it. I had a good friend who sent me an email. He loaned the book to one of his buddies who he was looking to be in business with, and his buddy refused to send it back because he had marked it up, bent the pages, yellowed it up, and he uses it, keeps it in his car whenever he's driving around and he reads it for inspiration. But he wrote 10 specific quotes from me, mm-hmm, and it was sort of funny. It was like the 10 commandments, you know. And the guy and my colleague sent to me a copy of the, forwarded the email to me. I am learning that there are many people, and I'm not exaggerating when I say this, who literally treat the book almost like a Bible or a business Bible, in a sense, mm-hmm, philosophy Bible, whatever you call it, mm-hmm, where they frequently go back, especially there's the Art of Negotiations, and I have to leave the one chapter you were talking about, mm-hmm, where I break down some of the little nuances in negotiating, mm-hmm, that people don't realize that may be being worked against you, or you may be able to use against your opponent. And it's one of the longer chapters because I had to delve a little deeper into the art of negotiations, because that's so terribly important for those of us who are in business.
Right.
You know, there's a piece on self-esteem and understanding the value of maintaining your self-esteem as, mm-hmm, part of that inner constitution component. Because, you know, if you look in the mirror, as I think I wrote, and you don't like what you see, then you do something about it. Mm-hmm. You know, we all have problems out here. And there's two types of problems. There are problems you have no control over. There's nothing you can do. In that case, you just walk away and you allow that problem to sit because there's nothing you can do about it. But then there are problems that you can do something about. And that is when you take action and you work on the problem that you can address. So you don't want to stress over those things you can't control. You want to focus on those things you can do something about. And that gets back to who you are and internally what you're about. And that having that confidence and self-constitution internal to your mindset and your way of doing business and thinking that I think is extremely important and something that you have to completely and totally embrace.
Yeah, I mean the way that you wrote your book is phenomenal. And I've read numerous business books. I have a lot of favorite authors, but I mean you really. I think when I sat down and spoke with you, I love what you said about you could have written your book years ago, but you wrote it after. You're not writing from a position of someone who's in the midst of trying to create wealth or build business, and you're giving some of the strategies that you learned just yesterday in the book. I mean, you really wrote a book from the perspective that you've already done this, and you're not trying to prove anything. You're really sharing. And so, as you just mentioned, I see success principles, I see self-improvement, building your potential, art of war. I see all of that in your writing, which made it so entertaining to read, and it keeps you spellbound. And you can't help but take notes. And I mean, I've scribbled up my copy with taking notes. And one of the other points that you really brought out was the difference between power and authority. Can you explain that?
Because
of the subtitles is about having wealth and authority, and you use authority as something that we should really be striving for.
Well, let's break it down this way. Wealthy people scream. Rich people scream, but wealthy people whisper.
Mm.
If you look at all the bling bling and the way in which people who define themselves as being rich treat life, you'll find that historically the so-called rich people tend to live their richness and eat it up before the next generation. Wealthy people, on the other hand, are building for the next generation. They want to create sustainable wealth and not just the bling bling.
Mm-hmm.
I see people with gold in their ears and nose, around their waist, their fingers and their toes, and they don't have $5 in their pocket.
Right.
They have to be careful on how that it is just not sustainable, and we have to focus on developing wealth. Now, let me describe the difference between power and authority. Too frequently, we use the word power, and we think, oh, I'm going to get some power. I want some power. That's fine. But let me define it so that people can understand where I'm coming from. The most powerful man on the face of the earth has been in the past the President of the United States. And I remember when George Bush and Condoleezza Rice went over to India and Pakistan, and the two, both of those countries are feuding on a regular basis, almost breaking out into war sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And the most powerful man on the face of the earth goes to the heads of their country and say, listen, we don't want a war to start here because it would affect the entire region, and war is not good, and you guys are, feuding over a few miles of land at the border. Well, the heads of Pakistan and the head of India looked at the most powerful man on the face of the earth. They thumbed their nose and said, listen, this is our country. You need to go on back to your country and take care of your business.
Mm-hmm.
Well, at the same time, in both India and Pakistan, companies like Motorola, Microsoft, Dell, and many of the large computer companies are spending billions of dollars in Pakistan and in India, building companies and facilities, and they are creating a middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what if Michael Dell were to go to the heads of those countries and said, you need to start feuding, because if you create a war or a problem that will affect the flow of my computer chips in and out of this country where we're assembling computers, I will pull my businesses, my plants out of your country and affect the growth of your middle class. Mm-hmm. Now, Michael Dell has authority. President Bush had power. Mm-hmm. Which would you rather have? Mm-hmm. You see,
authority
is a very strong word that relates to a continuation of existence. You see, the most powerful man on the face of the earth may get four years, may get 8 years, but when he's when it's over,
mm-hmm.
where's the power in that person? You see?
Right.
The power is in the office. The Honorable Barack Obama, our president, is the most powerful man on the face of the earth, and will be for the next 4 years. But when it's over, the power shifts.
Mm-hmm.
But authority through capitalism and growing businesses and creating jobs and moving a class of people into a middle class environment by the thousands is a very strong authoritative move, and it's sustainable. So wealth is sustainable. Being rich and powerful, it passes. It just doesn't play long term. So that's why I want people to make another distinction between being rich and being wealthy. Mm-hmm. And I hope that sort of those examples made it clear for people to adhere to.
Crystal clear. And I think you used the term in the book, power is fleeting, and I like that. It's not enduring such as authority.
That's right.
Now, you mentioned actionary. We've actually said it several times, and I see a couple questions coming through. Can you define what an actionary is? They've heard us say it a few times, but can we give a definition to actionary so that people can really wrap their minds around it?
Yes. An actionary is a person who takes their ideas, their dreams, their vision, their passion, and they pursue them with courage and confidence and bravado. It is almost, when I coined this word, actionary, it almost is self-explanatory. What is action anyway? Action, as a human being, as a creature, we are in action. Our heart is always beating, our vascular system is always flowing, our brain is always alert and alive. Even when we're sleeping, we're in action. And my point is, the actionary says, okay, well then I need to take action toward my business and my vision and quit waiting for something down the road or another time or finding excuses. An actionary does not do that. In fact, I might add that there's some people that are pushing to create the National Actionary Society where we actually begin to have dialogue and seminars on what is, and as we better define it, you know, it comes through the individual, and when it's all said and done, if you're an actionaire, it means that you are not going to wait any longer. You're going to take action on your ideas and your vision.
Okay, great. I mean, we're flooded with questions, but I know we're running short on time. But there are just two questions that, and I'll try to combine. I'm reading a few of them, and what I want to do is kind of combine them. And many are asking about how do you raise money for startup businesses. I guess people are asking about crowdfunding. Do you recommend crowdfunding or Kickstarter? How do you recommend that people begin to raise money? I know it's kind of a general question, but we tend to get that a lot about people in their startup phase. How do they raise capital? What are your suggestions or your thoughts on that?
Well, the President and the Secretary of Commerce placed me on the National Advisory Council for Innovation and Entrepreneurship, and I sit there with 26 other people, people like Steve Case, the founder of AOL, and the presidents of universities, like one in Michigan, the University of Michigan, is on it. And we also have venture capitalists and angel capitalists. So some of the best locations outside of Startup With Your Family and Friends, looking at the, you know, of course you meet with the bankers and you try to convince them that you have strong collateral to lend money to get, so that they can get paid back. Sometimes you might have to look to SBA, Small Business Administration, who has a variety of programs where they guarantee the loans to the banks to help support you in your efforts. There are venture capitalists, and you can go online and look up venture capitalists and angel capitalists. They are people who loan money to ventures if they see that the ventures will pay off, of course, long-term and be successful. You know, frequently, for most of us, it's a lot of sweat equity in our businesses. And, you know, sometimes we just have to borrow a little bit or save some money in order to get our launch. It is not easy, and you know, every business has its own unique characteristics. So, unfortunately, I wish I could give the person asking the question a more clear detail for what they need, but I can't do it because I don't know what it is. But I just gave you a range of business of opportunities to see where you might be able to go.
Okay, great. And that is the range. They're coming from all over. Some are startups. Some are asking about government loans, nonprofits. So there's a range of questions about finance, and I think you've covered that for what people can begin to point themselves in the right direction to get that information. Business plans. People are asking, are business plans obsolete? What are your thoughts on, I guess, the traditional business plan is what is this Susie? She's asking about, do you need a business plan to start a business nowadays? And a few people are asking similar questions. And I guess it goes back to the traditional financing of what do they need to go into a bank to get financed?
Well, there's two. That's part of it. But the other part is, you know, a business plan is basically a roadmap. I mean, mm-hmm. if you've never driven from Detroit to Wichita, Kansas, you won't know how to get there unless you have some kind of a map, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in your business, you do want to outline and sketch out what is your business, you know, where's the market, how are you going to manufacture if you're going to manufacture, you know, where are the supply lines for all of that? And you know, who's going to handle the accounting? How is it going to be done? I mean, a business plan is important from the standpoint of you creating your map towards success.
Mm-hmm.
A detailed business plan is frequently needed if you're going to have venture capital or other lenders or investors for that matter. You know, people who may be interested in buying a share or shares in your business, you know, you might want to go out and put together what's called a private placement memorandum, where you have a variety of funds, if you're big enough to do this, to fund your idea or your companies. That may mean going after credit. You want to be credit worthy, of course. So there are pension funds that, like the firemen and the policemen and the teachers, all of those different funds that exist in your cities, and your politicians will know, you know, people who sit on those fund boards, and they ought to push them to invest in you in your city, because candidly, what happens is you'll get a teacher's board, for example, in a Detroit, and you're going to be there with hundreds of millions of dollars of money that has to be invested. And frequently, it's the big boys that come in and say, well, invest with me or invest with me. Well, I think that when you look at the fact that most of those businesses, I mean, most of the people contributing are actually African-American teachers or policemen, then some of that money needs to be set aside for higher risk job creating smaller businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I propose that we have you know, the local councilmen and mayors to start to press that issue with those pension funds that exist inside of their cities. So that would, I'm getting a little revolutionary here, but that's what we may need in order to help raise the money necessary for our smaller sort of businesses.
No, I think you're so right, because I mean that's really the concern with a lot of startup entrepreneurs. Of course, we try to encourage people to at least have a model to prove your concept, to do some things on a smaller scale, and then scale up by taking that proven concept to, as you mentioned, venture capitalists, angel investors, and things like that. I know we're winding down right now, and there's tons of questions, but one of the things that I, before we get some closing or parting words from you, some closing thoughts, you also had a chapter in there, and this is something that I truly believe in, especially nowadays. I see so many people starting up businesses or attempting to start businesses, and they're going into arenas that they're truly not passionate about or don't have the necessary skill set to really flourish in that industry. But you wrote something about following your calling and creating your destiny in the book. And how important is it for entrepreneurs of today to start businesses or try to find their calling and build businesses around that, as opposed to just jumping from opportunity to opportunity and not really having a passion or strength around that?
Yeah, well, I think that, we're all different. We all have different perspectives on things, and that's good. That's what makes life in this country, in this world, rewarding. But if you have a calling, if you have a special skill, maybe you're an artist and you've come up with some kind of new device to make lights work longer than they have in the past, but you also want them to be creative and look cool, and people want to buy them because not only are they energy efficient, but they're also cool looking. The great thing about where we are in this world, and understand what I mean by that, this is a global economy, and as we look at creating our businesses, we absolutely must consider the globe and everyone on the planet as potential customers. We cannot just operate, in a small vacuum anymore. And how interesting is it if I come up with an idea, I can get online and I can go to developmyideas.com in India. Then I could take the idea that they developed for me and go to buildthisideaforme.com in China, get it built, go to Facebook or some of the other innovative locations and say to everyone out there, buythisfromme.com, go to PayPal's and set it up so that you can do that through a credit card, and then go to Craigslist and find accountant.com who can handle my books for me, and
right,
then be able to go over to the bank and make my deposits virtual on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what I just described, as simple as it may seem, is actually quite doable.
Correct.
So I just want people to know that we're in a very innovative time, and we have to be prepared to look at all opportunities globally and recognize that we are in a great position to do business all over the world and never leave the comfort of your home.
Yeah, that's right. All right. Well, Mr. Roberts, I thank you so much. I could just ask you question after question after question. I mean, this has been very refreshing and very rewarding to have this opportunity to speak with you. So I would just ask if you have any closing thoughts, and, of course, let people know exactly how they can get the book. Of course, I'm going to have links on my site so that they can go and get the book, but if you could let them know where they can go and get the book, or if they need to want to try to join the society that you mentioned, or anything else that you have coming up, could you let our listeners know how they can get in contact with you or your representatives?
Well, my webpage is www.michaelvroberts.com. MichaelVRoberts.com. They can click on and they can follow me. You can Google me. I've got speeches on YouTube. I do commencement speeches and accept a lot of speaking engagements all over the country. I'm fairly easy to find, to be honest with you.
Right.
And I'm happy to just get as many people engaged in business as possible. And let me just say, for those who are thinking about retirement, for example, I submit you should never retire. After all, we are all creatures, animals, we're homo sapiens. Now, what other animal on earth retires? Mm. I mean, if a lion retired tonight, he becomes his brother's breakfast in the morning. I want people at the age of 18 or at the age of 80 to consider a business or following your dream and your passion. I'm really encouraging this idea of entrepreneurship and capitalism. I mean, there are a lot of people who use that word out of our race, and I am just one that's going to keep pushing it and pushing it and pushing it because, you know, I know that it's going to make the difference in the end. I want us to be innovative with our thoughts. You don't have to invent anything. You just have to be creative and innovative. And what does that mean? Let me set a couple of quick examples and then we'll close.
Sure.
When IBM created the computer, they invented the computer. Bill Gates did not invent the computer. Some people think that he did.
Mm-hmm.
But he just created a software that made it ultimately possible for he and Dell and others to be able to create a laptop so that we would be able to have access to a computer. IBM slept on that. Bill Gates became innovative and created that using the base of the computer. But then came the search engines, the Googles, the AOLs, and then you found that the Bill Gates of the world slept on the use of this type of use of the computer in his own software. And then those people made millions. And now today, the next innovator on top of that would be Facebook, social networking. All of that's innovation on top of the IBM computer. And Henry Ford did not invent the automobile. He invented a rapid manufacturing capability so that it could be an affordable vehicle for people to have in the United States. He was innovative. He was not the inventor of the automobile. He was an innovator on the automobile.
Mm-hmm.
So when you look at what is the word innovation meaning, so those of us who are looking at being in business, it means that we take, you know, the ideas of others and we embellish on them and we grow them. And we then can add our own patents on top of them, actually. So it is critical for us to be ready to do big things. We're poised. The economy is now on a recovery. People make the mistake of waiting too long. You know, now is the time to get into business. Over 50% of the Fortune 500 companies started during a recession or a bear market. We are coming out of that now, so this is the time to go into your business and enjoy the uptick and not to sit back and wait for someone else to enjoy the uptick and do what so many other people have done in the past and then say, oh, I had that idea 3 years ago. No. Now is the time to take action. Action has no season. We have to be aggressive, be comfortable, be confident, pursue them with all the vigor and vision and passion that we can, and let's face it, there's only gains here because we've eliminated the fear of failure tonight. Mm-hmm. We are no box thinkers, and we are actionaires. So I bid everyone good day and good evening and good morning, and whenever you hear this, think well of us, and try to do what you can to be contributors and job creators. And when you do that, wealth will come your way. It will be sustainable and generational. Thank you very much for having me on today.
Thank you so much, Mr. Roberts, for taking the time out to speak with us. And you have a great evening.
Thank you for listening to My Conversations with Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs. And if you want more tips, more strategies, more notifications that would really take you into the mindset of these brilliant Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs, I need you to take out your phone and text My Brother, that's the key word, My Brother, to 58885. Just text the keyword, My Brother, to 58885. Or if you prefer, you can go online and just go to blackmillionairemindset.com. And once you enter your name and your email, I will immediately send you my video training, 10 Keys to Unlock Your Own Millionaire Mindset. So again, you can go to blackmillionairemindset.com, enter your name and email, and I'll send you the video training, or you can text the keyword, My Brother, to 58885, and I'll make sure that you get the video training. This is your brother Bedford, and I look forward to seeing you and hearing from you in the next Conversations with Black Millionaire Entrepreneurs. Take care.